The saying goes, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. But what if you don't have access to fresh produce where you live? Or transportation to the doctor if that apple doesn't work? Or someone to watch your kids while you're at the doctor? Or, you get the point. A person's success in managing their health and wellness may depend much less on what happens inside of a doctor's office than what happens outside of it. There's plenty about where we are born, grow, live, and work, and how these circumstances are shaped by access to resources that influence the health we can achieve. There's a name for it: social determinants of health. So as a community, how might we begin to address these social determinants? How might we make progress towards reducing health disparities and improving health equity? How do we create a future where people receive support to stay well, rather than just treating them when they are sick? It starts with research. It starts with conversations. It starts with listening. It starts with understanding. Supporting people in their journey to good health is part of how we can create a better world. I'm Ellen Beckjord. Good Health, Better World is a show about how stronger communities begin with good health for everyone, even outside the doctor's office. In this second episode, we hear from Julie Design, Chief Program and Policy Officer of the United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania, and Dr. Dan Swayze, Vice President for Community Services at UPMC Health Plan.
In every medic's background, you've walked into situations that you're like, wow, how is this occurring? There is so much that's happening behind closed doors. I mean, it's mind-blowing to me. Every one of us carries numerous patients with us every single day and the things that we've learned from those patients. But the one that sticks out in my head was walking into a person's home and realizing that they had no running water, electricity cord that was coming from a neighbor's home that was being reimbursed by $2 here, $2 there. And this person owned their own business for eons, and just a whole conglomerate of just bad events ended up in this situation. It was starting to get to be winter, and how are you going to stay warm? A propane heater is how they were heating their house, and just in a little tiny room. Not what I thought when I was walking up to this big, beautiful home. My name is Heather Bogdan, and I am the operations supervisor for the Connect Community Paramedic Program. And that program is dealing with vulnerable patients within Allegheny County. A lot of times we have referrers that will call into us and say, I have so-and-so, such-and-such age, and I am looking for something because they keep coming back to us in the hospital, or I keep seeing them on an ambulance. And I'm wondering what happens because I take them to the hospital. Maybe they got fixed in the hospital, they come home, and now they're broken again, and here I am retaking them to the hospital. Phone and computer just aren't enough for people to have a social connection with individuals, and they can find that at a hospital.
What's that? What's the emergency?
If I call 911, I'm going to have two very friendly people show up at my house, and they're going to be very nice to me, and they're going to talk to me, and they are a human within my house. After we would get a patient to agree to an initial assessment telephonically and or on video chat, and we will talk with them for an hour, hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours, and we just try to get to know them so that we can really truly understand what makes them tick. After that initial assessment, that's what we go back to. We put our thinking caps on and attempt to figure out what community resources might help them, whether it be community or offered within an insurance plan or offered through a local church or support group. we will knock on someone's door if they're not answering our phone calls or our attempts to reach them. We truly are just helpers, and we want to collaborate with a patient and follow what that patient wants to happen and get them connected to the resources that they want to see.
So pleased to welcome Julie Design to the Good Health, Better World podcast. Julie is the Chief Program and Policy Officer of the United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania and oversees a lot of the wonderful work that that organization does. Welcome, Julie, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Let's just start by talking a little bit about the United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania. There's lots of grant-making initiatives, of course, the 211 helpline. Tell us a little bit about the organization and the role that it plays as part of the important safety net.
So United Way is a fundraiser and a grant maker, but I think more importantly, and one of the things that we've really found during this time that's been so critical, is that we're really a convener and a problem solver. We've found, here's what's happening on 211, here's the calls that we're getting, here's what people are experiencing, and a lot of times there weren't resources previously to meet those needs. And so we brought people together and we developed new resources. We developed a regional transportation network. We developed a students and families food relief program, and really bringing together business and government and nonprofit. So yeah, really bringing together from across, business, nonprofit, government, to really figure out what are the things that we need to do to meet the needs of people during this time. We have trained resource navigators who really walk you through what's your presenting issue. And then kind of beyond that, United Way is partnering with the POISE Foundation and Allies for Children. We've created this community pulse report that uses 211 data and other data to try and help us get ahead of what is happening and what might happen. The number of people that are seeking preventive care and getting immunizations, like all those numbers are way down. It's very disconcerting to think about what it's going to mean going forward.
Sometimes it's hard to know kind of on the ground which social determinants are affecting whom and how, but you're using the Community Pulse Report, it sounds like, as a way to not just use 211 as a critical way to link people to services that they need, and in some cases, as you pointed out, build new resources or create new resources to meet needs if they weren't there to begin with. Is that right?
Absolutely. Most data sources are going to lag 2, 3, 6 months, a year. 211's hearing from 500 to 1,000 people every day. And so to be able to, just in Southwestern PA, so that's really important data to keep ahead of, so we can, have some little window into the future at this time.
What are some of the most important partnerships in Southwestern Pennsylvania, or really across Pennsylvania, for the United Way?
I mean, we've partnered with everyone through this pandemic. I mean, traditionally, I think, one of the really unique things about United Way is our connection to the business community, but also working with government, with other nonprofits. We've partnered with our nonprofit agencies and 211 and, for example, the Allegheny County Department of Health. We created an emergency basic needs network that is across our regional footprint in Southwestern PA. And so creating this network of, it's been between 6 and 10 agencies across the region that can back up 211. We don't have a resource for you now, but let me connect you with this, group of agencies. They can talk with you more in depth, help you understand what your issues are, and help resolve. I think also one of the big issues that came up was just that people couldn't get places, even if they, if they previously relied on the bus or they even had a car, but they were worried about going to a public place because they didn't want to be exposed to the disease. And so, we set up almost in the beginning this regional transportation network with companies like Access Transportation and much smaller neighborhood organizations like Oasis Transportation to they've moved, you know, hundreds of thousands of meals and 25,000 pounds and going of, you know, shelf-stable food and tens of thousands of boxes of diapers and PPE that just across 10 counties, really. That didn't exist before, but it's been so needed.
It sounds like that not just a transportation need through the regional transportation network and other resources, it sounds like you were able to really quickly be able to put together a net of resources to respond to that emerging need.
Yes. And I'll add, you know, you asked about partnerships and kind of the flip side of that has been, so one, needing to meet the need, but, you know, when we launching that regional transportation network, there are about 60 drivers that would have been unemployed that were, you know, then put to work through this regional transportation network.
Until this pandemic is over or, you know, subsides. What do you think about whether we can maintain the momentum that it's built around, you know, really shining a spotlight on the needs that people have?
I think that there have certainly been so many relationships that are kind of, let's call them, forged in pandemic, right? Obviously, things always like calm down after a pandemic and you forget a little bit. But I think if we keep thinking that way, like what is ahead and what is ahead that, and it can help us like kind of stay. I think I would also say that, you know, there were a number of reports in Pittsburgh recently. They weren't new, but, you know, really highlighting the racial and gender disparities in Pittsburgh and southwestern PA in particular. And then so much has happened during the pandemic to really raise the awareness of those issues. And that's one where it just, we can't let it go, right? Like it has to, it's been laid bare so many times, like hopefully it's got to stick. And we have to agree as a region that we need to take some very serious steps together to make difference.
One of the themes that keeps coming up across different folks is this theme of partnership, you know, a meaningful partnership. What have you found really promotes meaningful partnership in the context of the work that you do?
Trust. You know, it's so important. If I'm going to lean on you, I need to know that you're going to, you know, you're going to hold me up. And it only takes, you know, once or twice of that not happening when you're just not going to go back.
You mentioned that the 211 operations that you're overseeing are both for southwestern and southeastern Pennsylvania, as well as northwestern Pennsylvania too. You know, Pennsylvania is a large state. I'm just curious if there's a lot that's in common with what you're hearing about as far as where the needs are and the emerging needs, either before the pandemic or during the pandemic.
There are definitely some, you know, small differences, but I'll tell you what, the 211 is always, you know, help with rent, help with food, help with basic needs, utilities have always been among our top calls, always. It's just, and across Pennsylvania, and honestly, across the United States, when you look at 211 data, it's the same. And, you know, you think it'd be different during COVID, and it's the same. It's more intense. So you had asked before, like, what happens when you call 211? And our folks are really trained to, they know how these things, you know, kind of interconnect. And if someone calls, they've lost their job or they're, you know, when you get to a point where you're calling a helpline, right? You really need help. And either we can have it on this conversation on this phone call today, or we can have it if you want to call back next week. But, you know, how are you doing with food? Like, do you need help getting back to work? Like, are there agencies that we could connect you with? Those are things that, you know, we're really trying to get to that kind of like holistic response to the person, because they just all go together.
You know, the pandemic has, I think, brought vulnerability to the forefront for so many people, even though we know it's disproportionately affected communities of color and traditionally underserved people. But But one place where I think there's been some equality has been in the degree to which a global pandemic makes people feel vulnerable. I wonder if you think there's any chance that that might have the effect of destigmatizing the need for help. But do you think that this is making us as a culture less, having less stigma around the fact that that help is needed by many of us at one point or another?
I'm going to answer that two ways. I think one, yes, I think that people are more sensitive, and we've seen people like stepping up and being, you know, very generous because they realize, like, you know, that this is happening to so many people, and when something becomes real to you or your neighbor or your friend, like all of a sudden, like you can feel it in a different way. But I would say, you know, on the other hand, I think that there have been very different experiences of this pandemic for you know, working class versus white collar, for, you know, black and brown versus white, even for men versus women. Part of our mission is to be able to, you know, help people understand, like, this is you, and this is the person maybe across the cube from you, or this might be the person, you know, that, you know, took your coffee order this morning, or that, you know, helped you, you know, or those that drove your bus this morning. I would certainly want to encourage anyone that is experiencing need or that knows someone who is to either dial 211 or to reach out via text at 898-211. Just send your zip code, and one of our trained resource navigators will be in touch with you. And even if you're in the healthcare profession, for example, and you have someone in your office and they're experiencing something that is not an area of expertise for you per se, but more of those social service, that's another, you know, reason to call 211. We have a lot of, you know, professionals that call on behalf of clients or people that they're working with. It's, you know, it's like 211 is like your live, kept up to date all the time Rolodex of the old days, right? And so I think it's just a good resource for everyone. We have a very comprehensive, large database. Like, don't replicate it. You don't need to know that stuff. We know it. Let us help you.
Wonderful. Well, Julie, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today on the Good Health, Better World podcast. And I'll tell listeners that if you'd like to learn more about the United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania, about 211, which as Julie described, can be accessed via web, phone call. You can text your zip code to 898-211 to access 211 services. All of that information and more will be available in the episode's show notes. Julie, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
It's really a pleasure to welcome Dr. Dan Swayze to the Good Health, Better World podcast. Dan is the Vice President of Community Services for UPMC Health Plan, and he is also the Director of Operations for UPMC Innovative Home Care Solutions. Dan, you're one of my most treasured colleagues, and I'm so glad that we get to take this time to have a conversation today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. I look forward to talking to you, Ellen, as always.
As a pioneer in the emerging field of paramedicine, can you talk about what community paramedicine or community paramedics, what is that? And how is it different from what people might traditionally think of?
Sure. When you think about the traditional role of paramedics in a community, it's to respond to emergencies, right? So somebody calls because they're in some form of distress. And in the 1960s, when this was all stood up, that distress often came in the form of somebody having a heart attack or somebody being in a car accident. And at that time, unfortunately, before EMS existed, you had a better shot of surviving a gunshot wound in Vietnam than you did at having surviving a car accident in suburban U.S. So they trained medics to be capable of providing advanced life support care at any given moment in any conditions, like they trained the medics in Vietnam to do. Fast forward though 50 years, and now most of the 911 calls coming in fact, in the across the country, when I talk to folks about the nature of the 911 work, 80% of these calls have nothing to do with a medical emergency. They're calling because of a whole host of other crises that they don't know how to handle, and they don't know who else to call. 911 has become the only form of universal health care we have in the United States. When you think about it, it's the easiest system of care to access. We don't ask for insurance. We don't make you go through an application process in order to get help. You call 911, and within 10 minutes, two very nice people are going to come out and try to help you get out of whatever crisis situation you're in. So what we had found was that the medics were getting frustrated because they felt the people that called 911 weren't calling it for what it was designed to help with, and that's dealing with these medical emergencies. So we said, then let's train the medics to deal with the emergencies that people are calling for rather than continuing to frustrate them. And so that led us to introduce new things to the paramedics. We gave them a much deeper dive into behavioral and mental health issues. We just added things like trauma-informed care, so they understood what types of things may have precipitated this person resulting in the situation. And then most importantly, what do they do about it? In the 911 setting, we're held accountable to time standards. We need to get in and out of there very quickly. And we said, take a moment, take a breath, figure out what this person actually needs, which system of care is most likely to help this individual, and let's get them connected to that system of care rather than just assuming that the emergency department is going to solve all of their problems. And since we've stood this model up, there's about 400 or 500 programs like ours in the country now where communities are really recognizing the value of doing this different type of approach, using their 911 service to deal with any hazard that people call 911 for, not just assuming that it's a medical emergency and applying the medical solutions that we've had in the past to these things.
You have started to meaningfully transform the way healthcare gets delivered, right? You've added this new aspect to care that wasn't there before, but you've done it from within inside the system. You've been in the UPMC system for a long time.
Yeah, over 20 years.
Can you talk a little bit about your journey and what that's been like? And maybe if there's been resistance or what's facilitated your being able to bring about real meaningful change?
Other communities have done much greater things in a much shorter time frame than we've had to do. The transformative work is really just about aligning the brilliant people that we have within our system, taking and stealing the way that they apply their solutions and bringing them into the problems that we were having in the 911 system. So we didn't invent community health work. We stole it and then applied it to paramedics. We didn't invent social work, but we just took the stuff that they do out of social work and gave it to a new workforce and allowed them to have more tools in the toolbox than we've traditionally given them.
Can you talk about the spectrum of community-based services that you're leading and that you're working on with others at UPMC Health Plan?
Yeah, so this is really an exciting time for me because I have a whole army available to help us now, and it's one of the best-kept secrets of UPMC. I have 100-plus people now that are very quietly helping people in their kitchen and in their living room, just trying to figure out what problems are you having right now. It could be health-related, it could be otherwise, and that workforce really consists of everybody from community health workers, where we're taking them and putting them in these new roles, so taking people off of the streets that live in those communities that really represent those communities, giving them a little bit of training in terms of how they can help their neighbors and really helping them become an integral part of our workforce. We also have very traditional nurses and social workers who have stood up and said, I can help people. So we have a whole army of folks out there now that are just trying to identify the most vulnerable of us, the people who are really struggling the most with a whole variety of issues, again, healthcare related and not, and getting to know them on a very personal level. Let's help fill in the gaps for them and get them connected to the right system of care.
So just a moment ago, you said, you know, these folks are trained to address a whole spectrum of needs, healthcare related or not. But at the same time, social determinants of health has been a buzzword for a long time. Do you think that we've really transitioned into really meaningfully acknowledging what that means and then putting workforce behind it?
I think we've reached a tipping point. I don't think we're quite all the way there. We're certainly early in the adoption stage of this, where it's easier to have these conversations now than it was even a couple of years ago. But I still think that there's a lot of questions about just the nature of the help that we can provide. we're a health payer, so we're used to having to pay for everything in the medical system. We don't have to pay for everything in some of these other systems. There are existing systems of care that are out there that have stood up some really critical community resources we can turn to now and say, let's work differently together than we have in the past. Not just referring people to your program and hoping that you can help them. Let's really figure out a whole host of other things that need to go along with this so that they can meet their mission as a community-based organization and we can help our members as a health plan.
So what it brings to mind for me is that famous quote, and I don't know who said it, but that a system is perfectly designed to deliver exactly what it produces, right? And our healthcare system in this country is perfectly designed to take care of very sick people, right? And so America is a great place to have cancer or to need a hip replacement, but it can be a pretty hard place to just be a regular human, right? And these other services that you're talking about that we seek to partner with, you know, are where those social services and some of those preventive services come from, because our healthcare system just is not currently well designed to deliver them. But do you see these community-based services as something of a bridging function in the middle between what the system currently does and then all of the social services that we know exist that we're trying to link folks to?
I think it's a great point. So we have these disparate siloed systems right now, and the healthcare system is the de facto place where all of these patients, regardless of their need, end up. And it is a perfectly designed system for things like housing. It's just the most expensive system, right? So we can put you in a hospital bed overnight at $6,000 a night. We could probably find a much cheaper option if we were to work collaboratively with somebody who has other housing options available. I can feed you if you want hospital food at a very expensive price. Wouldn't it be better? Wouldn't it be smarter for us to connect with the food bank and really develop a different distribution model so that we didn't have to rely on the hospital as being the source for all that? If I am going to offer an alternative to patients that call 911, then I need to figure out where to get them, which bridge they need to cross, but they know how to get to where the system of care that they do need that help from. And that is the critical role I think we're playing.
And thinking about that work, it becomes then, I think, very clear how you can establish a whole new, incredibly important aspect of the healthcare workforce that doesn't have to go to medical school, that doesn't have to complete post-high school education, that just has to be positioned to help people navigate these incredibly complex systems. There's such, it seems, an incredible opportunity here to galvanize a new aspect of the workforce that can be relatively easily empowered to deliver that service and can be drawn from the communities that they need to serve. And how do you think that trust plays into the role of the community health worker or community-based services in general as we seek to expand the availability of those services? Is trust a barrier?
You think about all the things that get in the way of trust. We speak a different language in medicine than most people speak. We often don't look like them or come from the same background. Whereas in my world, when we're in these communities, in these living rooms and kitchens with folks, trust is not assumed. Part of that trust comes from us standing up these community health workers and peers to say, not only can you trust me because I've been there, but I represent hope that you can't see in yourself right now.
I want to ask about this demand that I know you face in your role, this demand to scale. How do we think about scalability when it seems obvious that true, authentic human connection is so critical to the way forward?
So if we're going to scale our interventions, we have to realize we cannot do this by ourselves. We have to find the problem solvers in every community. And guess what? They're there. And I think as we get into these community spaces more often, as we develop more of these community relationships, what we're going to find is that the helpers have always been there. We just never knew to ask. And so as we look for ways to scale this to our geographies, to scale this across Pennsylvania, what we need to focus on is who is already solving a problem that is a part of all the things that we're trying to solve. There are centuries old in some cases. We just have not been able to figure this out. But rather than focusing on that, if we reach out and say, let's focus on finding the problem solvers and finding a new relationship with them, I think we're going to see that a lot of the things that we've been struggling to scale will come naturally.
I agree. One of the things I think that you're absolutely doing that is leading to the scalability of these high-touch, deep support efforts is training. You have a training program to create community paramedic programs or perhaps broader sets of community services that you deliver all around the country. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so what we had to build that, right? So I wanted to take medics off of the street and to get them to think differently about the patients that we're helping, giving them new tools. And what has evolved over that 17 years that we've been working on this now is really more on the job training or trying to find an orientation program to really get to some of the core competencies that we think you need when you perform this role. And so what we have learned is meet people where they are. So firefighters and paramedics have a long history of helping people with chronic illnesses. They just deal with the acute exacerbations of those diseases, right? Let's talk about something like asthma, but not what do I do if somebody's having an asthma attack. How do I help somebody manage their asthma better every day? And if you start from the fact that they've never had any training, in fact, a lot of these folks don't even like being in a classroom setting. Maybe we stop trying to force them into a classroom to be successful and start throwing a bunch of psychobabble at them to really help them reframe and rethink the way that they approach these and then giving them new tools to solve that. Well, I think that's the approach that we need to take in order to be successful and to really make this more approachable to them.
I do want to talk for a minute about social determinants. We talk about social determinants of health like it's one thing, but of course it's many, right? It's a very different experience to not have transportation than it is to not have food, right? And those are both in the social determinants category. Do you make any distinction between them or any that are more central or relevant to the work that community services is poised to do?
Unequivocally, I think the most important social determinant of health is the one that the member thinks is most important. We always follow their lead. If you want help with food first, we're going to help you with food first because that's what's most pressing in their mind. And from a population health standpoint, that's very strategic on our part. You may not say that we don't trust the member to know which is the most important. You know, if they're saying that they would prioritize their dog's food over their medications for their congestive heart failure, we have a guttural reaction to that as a healthcare provider saying, no, that's wrong. But if that dog is their only form of social support, if that dog is the reason that they're able to get through the day because they don't have a family, they don't have anybody else in their life, then I think they know better than we do how best to spend their money on those types of things. So I think if I ask you, Ellen, what do you think is most important right now and how can I help you through that? Then that doesn't assume any judgment on my part. It just says, look, I can't promise anything that I'm going to be able to fix any of this for you. I can promise you I'm going to try to help.
Right, when we think about 80% of what kind of predicts a health outcome happens outside of the clinical setting and is in the realm of social determinants of health, you know, what does that mean as far as the obligation of the healthcare system? And
I think we have a choice to make, quite frankly, and we could choose to do nothing. But what we know now is that the status quo is the most expensive solution. So if we don't figure out a way to determine our role, I think what you will find is that we are going to be more dependent on those community partnerships than we've ever had. But we're going to find pretty quickly, especially after the pandemic, is that those systems have always been underfunded and under-resourced. And they just don't exist at all in many communities. We can't build a bridge to nowhere.
You mentioned trauma-informed care. Father Paul Abernathy talked about trauma-informed community development. We talk a lot about health disparities in traditionally underserved communities and communities of color, but is living with the consequences of current and intergenerational trauma, you know, and the behavioral health, the mental health, the emotional effects of that, is that something that we talk enough about?
I'm going to try to answer this in by way of an example. So there are two communities that are 2.5 miles apart in Pittsburgh, Larimer and the border of Frick Park. There's a 25-year difference in life expectancy between people who live in Larimer and people who live in Frick Park. And I think that the folks in Larimer struggle with everything that you've talked about, this constant, recurrent, intergenerational trauma. I cannot treat members the same in those two communities, right? They're both going to struggle, and I can't tell you who's more likely to have a mental health or a behavioral health issue in those two areas. I shouldn't make any presumptions about that. I think when you look at it at a population level, there are systemic things that we're going to have to do to make a difference in those communities that we may not have had in our toolkit before. But at a personal level, and we cannot make assumptions about their ability or their disability to get through some of these systems of care. Just because somebody lives in that community, it doesn't mean they're able to figure this out on their own. Sometimes they just don't know where to start. And so what we're trying to do is embed as a core competency this understanding that people come from different life experiences overall. Some of that is intergenerational. Some of that does coincide with a mental health diagnosis. You can only imagine what we're going to face now that everybody's anxious and depressed about the situation that we're in now. And some of that is going to result in a significant impact on their ability to continue to work and function the way they were prior to the pandemic. I think our teams overall globally, a healthcare system overall globally, need to start paying attention to the fact that the mind and the body are so intertwined, we cannot keep treating them as if they're two separate organs. I'm not going to tell you that your heart disease is more important than your depression, and that's more important than your food insecurity. Again, it goes back to what's the most important thing for the member? What can I do in my role with my resources and knowledge to help you just have a better life than you had before we started to interact? And I think ultimately that's what we're trying to do for everybody. It's not just about improving the quantity of life that our folks have, but improving the quality of the life that they live as well.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about or share that we haven't talked about already that you'd like to have on the record for this episode of Good Health, Better World?
I think it's an open call. We as a nation are facing times that we've never faced in our generations. That's going to require us all to roll up our sleeves, get our hands dirty, approach life in very, very different ways. And so I know a lot of the listeners out there have their preconceived notions about what UPMC is and what it does and how it works. And what I'd ask them to do is challenge that. Don't assume that we're interested in just maintaining the status quo or taking our traditional approach to problem solving, because we're at a new place. We have to be. We cannot continue to do the things that have made us successful in the past and expect them to help us transition out of this pandemic phase, transition into whatever the future is going to hold for us. And so I think the community organizations that are out there, the providers that are out there that we've had these traditional roles, restart those conversations with us and see if there isn't an opportunity to partner with us in a way that is incredibly different than the way that we've traditionally interacted with you. And if we haven't had an interaction, please reach out to us to let us know that there's an interest in this particular community. Whether you're in rural Pennsylvania or in the middle of Center City, Philadelphia, we want to reach out to those organizations and figure out what can we do together to get through this, because it's the only way we're going to succeed.
I couldn't agree more. Well, Dan, you're such a wonderful leader, and I'm so grateful to have you as a colleague, and I'm so appreciative that you took time to be with us today on Good Health, Better World.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Good Health, Better World, presented by UPMC Health Plan. Have a joyous holiday season. Be sure to come back next time